As your name's first, I'll let
Okay.
you.
My name is Adrian Jenkins. I'm an escalation engineer, and I work on the same team as Brian. We work in the support organization. There are different tiers of support. You get to a first tier, second tier, then there's the third tier. Brian and I are at the third tier. So we're the guys who work with the problems that couldn't be resolved through other means and stuff like that. And Brian and I, we work very closely with the product group. So if there needs to be a fix or some solution given out, then we work closely with them to get the solution to you.
And my name is Brian Smith, and I'm also a senior escalation engineer, so all of the previous stuff applies, as Adrian said.
And we're senior not because of our age, but something else.
Yeah, I'm senior because of my age, and Adrian's senior to me because of he's been at Microsoft a lot longer than I have. So we're,
right.
we're
but
both
I have
senior
the
in
hair,
ways.
So
yeah.
It just doesn't, it's not
okay.
fair.
Okay.
Yeah. But so, we both still have hair. Yeah.
Yeah, just. We're going to be covering a few different troubleshooting tips, different angles, some of the diagnostics we can run, some things with SQL tracing that I'm going to be looking at, some of the sort of things that we use in our day-to-day job. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that these are the kind of things that you would necessarily do yourselves, but they might be. Sometimes it might be easier to sort of have a look around if you are comfortable with the tools that we're showing. You might find, you know, I can see what's causing this problem. That might give you a good idea what a workaround might be or something like that. So it might save you some time. But the other part of this is just understanding how we work with the tools so that, you know, sometimes you can help us to help you
right.
in terms of getting traces and things in.
Exactly. Yep.
We have got a few different things that we'll be sort of going over. I haven't really got another slide on the first point, so I'll sort of cover it off on this slide, and then the other stuff sort of follows on. But what makes a good repro? Whenever you sort of get in touch with support and you're telling us that something's broken, you need to be pretty specific about what's gone wrong and what you're seeing. Particularly as we move into 2013, when you say, I've got this task. Okay, is it a SharePoint task? Is it a workflow task? Is it a project task? Is your task just to phone support? And so you get the idea. There's lots of different ways of doing things in project. There's lots of ways that we use words over and over again to mean slightly different things. So having a good repro is sort of stepping through and telling us how you do things. We can sometimes see different behavior, perhaps a different code path, if you assign a resource through the build team dialogue, or you might assign them through the grid, or you might assign them through the task form.
Yep.
And some of those things could take it through a different code path, so we really need to know how you're doing things. We don't come back to that, but I thought it's something that's worth sort of bringing up, that you know the repro is king, really, in terms of if you tell us exactly what you're doing, hopefully we can sort of get to the bottom of it. Sometimes we can jump to conclusions. Well, this is how I'd do it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's how you did it or how it broke.
Yeah, a good example of that. Years back when I was beta testing Project 3.0, so that was a long time ago, I was able to reproduce a problem where the application would crash. I sent it to the developer and he says, I can't reproduce the problem. I said, well, I sure can. He says, well, I can't. So finally, he drove to my office, which at that time was probably about 10 miles away from where he was at. He says, okay, you show me. So I showed him, and I went through, and I, with the keyboard, I did everything that I would normally do. And he says, oh, well, there's the problem. He says, I've always been using the mouse to do the same thing. So it really helps to be very precise on what your steps are. Case in point.
So the other things we'll be looking at, sort of where to look for things when things go wrong, where to look if things are still going wrong. Talk about the logs and some of the troubleshooting tools of the trade that we sort of use in our sort of day-to-day work and the kinds of things that you can use as well. I mean, we won't be talking about sort of giving you source code and allowing you to debug the stuff. That's probably
even though
not
you would like
happen.
To.
But things like SQL Profiler, Fiddler, those kinds of things. And then we'll go on to troubleshooting using the client logs, and Adrian will be digging deeply into that. And we'll sort of come up with some time for questions. So where to look when things go wrong? I mean, these are the standard places that hopefully you're sort of used to looking for. The logs, we've got the ULS logs on the server side. You may need to change the verbosity to get the kind of logs that we're interested in. And obviously logs, they're only applicable to project on-premise if we're asking you for them. If it's project online, then we've got access to them. But don't be surprised if we still ask you for them, because you know, project online's new and we're still getting used to it. So we'll say silly things like, you know, can we get your databases and can we have your logs? And you'll
say, oops, sorry.
It was project online. So, and then the other logs, the PCS diagnostics, the upgrade, which of course you never ever need to worry about if you're using project online, because we're doing all that upgrading and config wizards and all that kind of stuff for you. The application event log. I was talking to somebody earlier this morning about project crashing. And if project crashes, generally in the app event log, you're going to have an event 1001. And hopefully if you're sending that sort of crash information to Microsoft, then people like Adrian and myself can make some sense of what that actually means when it gets to us. But also it gets sort of crunched through, and we also see how many other people are hitting that problem. So, you know, it might just be you if you're very unlucky and perhaps, I don't know, you've got a very specific driver on a very specific machine. You might be the only person who ever sees that crash. But generally, the crashes will be something that are sort of more widely spread. We don't like to pick on people. We'd like to give everybody some love. So you'll probably all see the crashes.
And if you don't see the event 1001, there is an event 1000, and you'll see winproj.exe, and then you'll see a bunch of other stuff associated with it. And with that information, we can at least tell where in the code the crash happened. We don't necessarily know how it got to that piece of code, because it's just basically a snapshot of the call stack at that point, but it can at least give us a starting point. I worked on an issue here recently where that's all I had to run on, and I looked at the call stack and I was able to kind of feel, it's like, well, it looks like they're doing this and this and that, and we were able to get close enough that we eventually came up with a fix for the problem. But, you know, at least give us that amount of information. That's very helpful.
And then the final point there, if you're doing anything on the client side, usually the logs on the installation of whatever it is are going to go into %10%. Slightly different in the click-to-run environment, but again, I think that's up on TechNet. We've documented where all those kind of logs can be got from as well if you're having any issues with a click-to-run install of Project Pro for Office 365. On the online side, I'm just not online as in Project Online, just to avoid any confusion. But if you're looking for information online, obviously we've got the TechNet Project Server Tech Center, we've got the MSDN Developer Center, there's loads of blogs out there, and there's forums as well. I've mentioned it at a couple of sessions that I've done. I'm finding that the search engines tend to be finding the forums pretty well these days. And that's great. If you're looking for the same question that you've asked, you can find other people that have asked the same question. And if you're really lucky, you'll find there's also an answer to that question as well. So one of the things that we're going to be moving into shortly is trying to make sure that the forums are clean, we're getting to them quicker, we're making sure that if somebody's answered the question, that a moderator has been in and said, yes, that's the answer. Because sometimes it's difficult to answer a question, perhaps there's not enough information there, and we'll have a guess, because you know, it's better if somebody gets a reply that might be the right answer rather than sort of not hearing anything at all. Sometimes we never hear back from the original poster. So you know, they'll post something saying this, this, and this happened, and you'll ask them a bit more and give them an idea what it is, and you never hear from them again. So we just have to sometimes just take those guesses and say, well, we think that's the answer, but the guy didn't tell us.
Yeah, so don't be that guy who posts and never replies back.
So we're putting extra effort into the forums because it's a great resource to find sort of useful information. The other thing you can find on the forums is if you look to see who answered the question, there's usually a number against their name. So that gives you an idea how reliable their answer might be. Not always. I mean, somebody could have a high score, but they might just be having an off day and have given a bad answer. Other times there might be somebody who's never answered a question in their life, but they've just given the perfect answer to a question. But you know, if you see a zero, you might think, well, you know, I might want to get some corroboration of that particular answer. Banner across the bottom is the Microsoft Project Support blog. That's on blogs.technet.com/project-support. We've sort of moved over from the stuff that I put on my blog, I'll usually put directly on there. So anything about the cumulative updates, service packs, those kind of things. I'll be putting on the project support blog. I still tend to put a pointer to that on my blog as well. So you can still go to blogs.msdn.com/Brysmith and you can find your way to all the stuff that we've got out there. So that's sort of where to look when things go wrong, which coincidentally also happens to be the places to look if they're still going wrong, because it probably means you missed it the first time you're looking through. And we move on to look at some specific diagnostic stuff. And for this, I need to come out of the presentation. And I'm going to run up a video. I thought I'd do a video rather than trying to sort of do this live for you. I could do it live, but then you'd be relying on my typing and everything else, and at least I know it's going to take a set amount of time if I use the video, whereas if I do it live, I'm probably going to mistype things and we'd be here all day. But we've got some diagnostic packages. I'm going to be showing you one. Adrian will be talking about the client side. So this is server side. So how many people have used the P12AC tool or the P14AC tool? Okay, a few of you there. That's a tool that we, our colleague, our equivalent, he's also a senior escalation engineer, Ake Chen, worked on, hence the AC, yep. For AC tool. And we've used that for quite a while in diagnosis of customer issues. So we built into that a lot of rules that we'll look at the database and work out whether there's a particular problem that we're aware of. And that might be an orphan baseline. It might be an issue with perhaps a reporting database missing some data, so something won't publish, those kind of things. We've now built that into a package which we can send out to you. You can run it. You can see what the results are as well, and then you can send that back to us as well. So I'll run you through that sort of process. So first off, you'd get this email saying, you know, click on the link below, and it would send this email out to you. Further down, I've sort of chopped it off just to try and keep the text quite big. It actually gives you a link to a TechNet article which explains what's going on. So if you're one of these people that thinks this might be, you know, going to Rickroll you or something like that, then you can sort of read the TechNet article and be comfortable that this is going to do what you need it to do. So I'll just sort of step through the following pieces. So you get the email, you'd click on the support link, and that would take you off to a site in a second, where it would then give you, well, this is the information I was talking about, so you can see what it's going to do. It'll tell you what it's using, tell you the technology behind it, talk about PowerShell, that kind of thing. And then once you've gone through that, you get onto this page, which will take you to the tool itself. So here you can click the run button. This is the PWA site that I'm going to be looking at. And when I click run, the video's weird here. The mouse is actually sort of about 45 degrees up to the left, so it didn't record quite how I'd wanted it to. So what it'll do, it'll load the tools for you. So it's downloading it, and then it gives you a choice in a second of where you want to run it. And you can actually run it on the machine you download it on, but chances are you might be wanting to load it on another machine. So here you can choose whether it's this computer, whether it's a different computer. And this will package it up. So you know, obviously, most servers aren't the things you'd be browsing to sites on, so you'd move it somewhere else. So here I run it. I start the package going. It will be collecting various bits of information. The main piece of information I'm going to be talking about here are what we call now the DB diags. So it's basically the stuff that's in the P14AC tool. So I give it my, previously was my SQL server. Now I'm giving it my database name. It then goes off. It asks me what I want to run. So by default, I want to run all. But there are some other options there as well. Just wind that back a bit. So by default, we do all stuff. The second option there is all but no PII. So if you're very concerned about us seeing the names of your projects or the names of your resources or anything like that, then what you can do is choose that option, and then it will strip that information out. So we still have all the GUIDs, and we still have the results of the diagnostics, and we'll know that a certain condition exists, but we won't be able to say to you, it's this project. We'll say, it's the project with GUID 123, ABC, whatever, and then we might have to help you work out which project that actually is. A few things there about statistics as well. So some of the information we pull back isn't so much diagnostics in terms of what's broken. It's just sort of broad information. So, you know, how many projects have you got that run for more than 5 years? Which projects have got the most assignments? Some stuff around your queue, for instance, is some of the other things that we can pull back. And also things like database fragmentation or sizes of your databases. So it's a lot of information that can help us grab everything at once, and then we can sort of review that and see what the particular problem is, hopefully. So I'll just get that moving forward again. So that runs through the database. My database is pretty tiny, as you'll see in a second. So it then tells you, okay, I've got all this stuff, and if you don't want to send some of this to Microsoft, then uncheck it, and then you can send it. And you can also save a copy. So I'm going to save a copy here, and I'm also going to send it off. So it sent it up to Microsoft, so I can close that now. But I want to have a look and see what's been captured as well. So I'm going to go to my copy of that, and this is the email I got because I sort of sent it to myself as well. So that's what the support engineer would see. And then these are the files that are getting produced as part of the output of that. Some are more interesting than others, and I'll be opening one or two of those.
Can you guess which one?
Yeah. I thought I'd edited out all the really boring slow bits, but perhaps I thought I'd say more during that point. I'll probably remember later what it was. So I'm opening up one of the XML files, so it tells me a little bit about what I'm actually running. And then I'm going to open up the main CSV file. So this gives us information. This is the sort of the output, which you can even load up into Excel. I didn't in this particular case. I've covered some stuff up because we've got some of our internal account names and things which I didn't particularly want to share out. But here it sort of tells you when it was gathered, it tells you what it's getting, and then it will sort of show you all the output. And basically what it does, and I'm not going to go through all the rules sort of one by one. I mean, you can, next time you've got a case open, ask them to send you a SDP package of the diagnostics, even if they don't think you need it. Just get them and say, I saw this stuff and it looked cool and I want one. So they'll send you this.
Everyone's doing it, so.
Sorry?
Yeah. Everyone's doing it, yeah.
So each of the rules sort of says, okay, I'm checking to see if there are resources within invalid base calendars. And that wasn't detected. I'm checking for tasks with multiple status managers. That wasn't detected. Sometimes we drop a rule if there's something that isn't applicable. So we might have had a rule for 2010, which can't possibly happen in 2013, then we'll take it out. So step through here. I'll probably just sort of leave this. It runs through pretty fast, but there's different patch levels it's checking for, transaction states, null conditions in various places. So we've got a problem there with the missing resource placeholder. So this means that something in the reporting database that doesn't match up to something that's being published. So that would cause a sort of publishing failure. So we know there's a condition in there. It gets some stats information, so how many people are in the different groups. It gets some information about the different projects and the project categories. I've got 17 projects. I'm a busy guy, you can tell. Some of those have got five tasks in, so this is big stuff. And it'll carry on down, getting more information. It'll start giving, if I'd used the no PII, I would not know that Bia is the only person that's got any assignments, because she's the only person at Microsoft that actually does any work.
Yeah, but she's here at the conference doing work.
Yes. Yeah. Again, it looks for cross-project links. It brings back some information on sort of how your various different settings are configured. And it finally goes through and it finds information on disk usage. And if there's any fragmentation in the indexes, it will sort of show it up as well. So it gets a good sort of round coverage of lots of stuff that's going on in the system. So that's probably about all that's worth showing there. It's near the end. I'll drag that off. The other cool thing is that press the right button then. I'll do it with the mouse. The other cool thing is that we've also built that into our internal diagnostics that we can run in Project Online. So all of the kinds of rules that we're running there, we can run through the diagnostic views in Project Online. We can't see any PII. We've got no choice of seeing PII in your tenants, but we have got diagnostic views which allow us to see the relationships between tables. So we're just looking for GUIDs. You know, is there a GUID in the baseline table that doesn't match up to a GUID in the project table? So we can still see if there's things broken. We just can't see the name of that project, the name of the resource, the name of the task. But it is good that we've got that sort of platform running across on-premise and online, so we can build those rules in. Obviously, we know in online where we're patched to, so potentially a lot of the rules that we're testing for couldn't possibly exist. But, you know, stranger things have happened.
Yeah.
So some of the other tools that we use in our sort of day-to-day work, and ignore the P14 DB diag coming soon. I sort of noticed it when I was going through my slides. I should have edited that and said SDP packages. You've just seen those. But it's the same kind of thing. We called it, instead of P14 AC tool, it got renamed to P14 DB diag, and then it got renamed to SDP packages. So all the same thing. So we use the application event log, client-side logging, which Adrian will be going into deeper. You can use this sort of F12 IE developer tool. Sometimes you can see if perhaps a PWA page is having a problem loading, you can see just what JavaScript files are being loaded up. Sometimes we'll find that a JS file that we're expecting to be there, you know, isn't showing up. Perhaps it's being filtered out somewhere by some hardware in your environment, something like that. IE right-click, I mean, that's a very underrated tool. You know, if you want to know the GUIDs of all of your custom fields, just go to your custom fields page in PWA, right-click, and that's the easiest way to find them. They're all buried in XML, so when I say easy, it's all relative, but it's a good way of finding all of them rather than going to each one individually and sort of seeing what the URL is. SharePoint developer dashboard, obviously for on-premise only. Fiddler, if you want to see traffic that's going back and forth between the client and the server. I think we've sort of used that pretty heavily for WinProj talking to PWA.
Yes.
And Netmon, so we can sort of see what's going on the network to see if there's any sort of packets being lost anywhere, that kind of thing. Very similar on the server, we've talked about ULS viewer. Sometimes we'll be using Perfmon just to see if we can establish where a particular sort of slowing down is happening. We're using PowerShell more and more, particularly in the Project Online environment. We're building most of our diagnostic tools with PowerShell to be able to sort of go off and we can just run a command, put in your particular tenant URL. It will go off using PowerShell and run various commands that we're allowed to use once we're in the telemetry environment. And it'll tell us what network you're on, what farm you're in, what data center you're in, and lots of other useful information about the state of your tenant. You know, are you currently being upgraded? Because sometimes there'll be a very short period when your queue goes offline when you're going through an upgrade, which you shouldn't normally notice, but sometimes perhaps it gets delayed a little bit longer. We'll be able to tell if your site, your tenant, is going through an upgrade at that process. Again, Netmon, usually you're looking at it on the client and the server, or possibly two servers if you're looking at the app server and SQL. Proj tool, that's a tool that shipped with the SDK in 2010 and 2007.
Right.
You can still use that,
allegedly. In 2013, I use it all the time.
Connect it to your production system, so when we say you can use it, we mean sort of in the privacy of your own test environment.
Here's something I use it for frequently. So if I want to test out something where I know I'm going to do a destructive test on a project, so I've opened up a project and I need to do something to it, like save it or see what the results are going to be, before I do that, I go through and I actually back up that individual project. And then after I do my destructive test and I want to do it again, I just go back into the tool, restore just that one project, and then I can redo it again and again and again. So it's very handy in that way. You can also send different PSI calls to the server to say, I want to create a custom field and have these properties on it, or whatever the case may be. So for me, I like the tool for those types of functions that it gives me.
Another useful tip on Proj tool, it shipped as part of the 2010 SDK. And at some point, we took a decision, a change, and we don't ship any compiled code in the SDK. So all the code is there for ProjTool, but you have to compile it yourself. Now, if you happen to search for Jim Corbin and the Project Programmability blog, you'll find that he attached it to a blog post, and the compiled version is still there. So if you happen to need it and don't want to compile it, that's a good place to go and look. So Jim Corbin and the Project Programmability blog, and you should and ProjTool, and that'll probably bring it up, and you can get that nice copy of it. It's where I always go when I've got a new machine and I haven't got it and I can't be bothered to copy it from somewhere else. Go to Jim's blog and it's there. Of course, I didn't tell you all of that, and I'll have to work out how to sort of hack that out of the recording afterwards. But just in case somebody hears that and takes it away again, Sorry?
I didn't hear a thing.
Good, good.
Okay, databases.
Yeah. I should have gone to mute then, shouldn't I?
Yeah.
So the client-server database, SQL Server Profiler, I'll be going into a little bit more. It's my sort of favorite tool. SQL Server Management Studio, the Diags I talked about, and so Netmon's really across the board. You know, you could be having problems anywhere. It could be the client, it could be the server, it could be right across to the database where there might be some traffic not getting through. So SQL Profiler Trace is my my favorite tool. So it's like when you've got a toolbox and you've only got a hammer. So I'll use SQL Profiler Trace to knock in screws and all that kind of stuff. I probably use it in totally inappropriate ways. It's probably not something you want to run in production unless you really know what you're doing. It can sort of slow things down. It's actually monitoring all the traffic that's going through to SQL Server. And certainly in terms of some of the stuff I'm showing you, if you can't understand what I'm doing, you probably don't really want to do it. It's something that I tend to use it to capture the queries that are happening against the database, and then I can rerun those against the database and see what the result set is. But it's very important that you only do that generally for queries that are just going to return data. I don't want to do any updates. You know, I don't want to sort of push all those timesheets through again because they've already gone there, and it'll probably give me some errors anyway. So it's usually stuff that's going to be sort of non-destructive. I just want to see, for instance, okay, I load PWA Project Center, and it doesn't load properly. Well, what is it trying to do? So I can do a SQL Profiler Trace in the background. I can see what queries were run. I can grab that query and put it into SQL Server Management Studio, run the query against the same database, and see what happens. And generally, I'm looking for how long it takes. Perhaps I've hit a timeout issue. What's in the columns? Is there a null where I'm not expecting there to be a null, for instance? Something like that. So you're generally looking for some abnormalities.
Just to throw in something, I get a lot of cases where it's like, well, something runs slowly. And so I use SQL Profiler a lot, and there's some actual settings and events that you can capture in SQL Profiler to get the show plan, XML, and that sort of thing so that I can actually see what the query was doing, see what indexes were being used for the query, and so forth. And so I use that a lot to try to figure out, can we improve performance better on the SQL Server?
Good one. So I'm going to go on to a demo. And this demo is another video, which I'll run from desktop. And this particular one is in the portfolio feature, and it is the hired resources report. So basically, the idea is I've put together a sort of portfolio of projects. I want to see how many resources I need to hire to be able to fulfill these particular projects. So I've got an analysis that I've already done. It's this bottom baseline one. I choose that I'm going to hire some resources, so I think I might need 5, so I'll recalculate based on that. And then I'll have a look at the... I'll recalculate again. And then I'll have a look at the hired resources report. Now, you may not easily be able to tell that anything's wrong because you may not know that you're only expecting to get one row and there's 2 rows. But and I'm only looking at one resource, so this was my sort of base cut-down repro where I could see the problem. But what it's doing, it's showing me that I've got one requirement because obviously the start and the end date are the same, the cost is the same, the work is the same, the rate is the same, but why am I seeing 2 rows? In the customer problem here, he was saying, well, I'm seeing every row twice, so, or potentially every row three times or four times, or yeah, I think you can't get much. Probably five would be the most. So you know, what's causing this? Why is it coming up with more rows than I'm expecting? So what I can do in the background is run a SQL profiler trace while that's happening. And I should be skipping over to that in a second. So here's the profiler trace that I'm sort of capturing. So I'm going through the repro again. I've started the profiler trace in the background. I put my resources in, I recalculate, and then I go and load the report. And I can then go back to the SQL profiler trace. And really what this is doing is capturing all the stuff that's happening in the background. So it's going off and it's checking permissions and it's looking for custom fields and it's reading the planner efficient frontier to produce the nice little pictures. There's some noise traffic down the bottom. It's doing some kube admin stuff. So occasionally you have to filter stuff out, particularly the queue jobs. So the timesheet queue and the project queue were filtered out before I even set this running. If I go forward, I think I find the particular thing I'm looking for, which I think is a bit further up. So that's one of the... You'd think I'd know where to go when I knew what I was looking for, but... So the line that I'm highlighting there, it's executing a stored procedure. And the stored procedure is called MSP Planner Read Resource Hired. So, you know, I'm a sharp guy. I can guess that that stored procedure is what feeds into the hired resources report. So what I can then do is get the full text of that execution. So it's executing that report with all of those parameters. So it's a particular solution UID. It's a particular analysis UID. It's got some dates in there. So I can just grab that particular command, take it over to SQL Management Studio, and run it against the same database. So there it is. See all the different parts of it. I execute it. And it pulls back a ton of stuff, but the key bit is, in the first row, I've got two lines. And if I think I scroll this over to the right a little bit, we can see here that I've got... Oh, let's go back a touch. I've got two rows, and the $60 is the standard rate, but if you remember on my report, both rows said $60, so it's not... that's a bit odd. The work was 344, so I know this is where it's getting the data from, but why is it getting two rows? And the next trick is to say, okay, well, what's that stored procedure actually doing? Because a stored procedure is really just a collection of SQL that's being executed. So I can open that stored procedure, and I can examine all the different parts of the SQL, and I can see what's going on. And I won't take you all through the depths of that particular stored procedure, but the key piece is, try to move on just a touch more. What I found was it wasn't doing anything with the rate tables. So I've got resources and they've got rates, but I wasn't filtering on the rate table, the specific rate table that I wanted to use. Because in the report, you can go into options. You can say, yeah, I want to run this report based on rate table A or rate table B or whatever. But what we were doing in the SPROC, we were ignoring that. So we were getting all of the rates, and as a bonus, we were then putting the last rate against all of them. So that's why you saw 60 on both rows and not 50-60. So in this case, the particular fix was saying, okay, we need to make sure that the rate table that we're looking for is the rate table that we selected. So by taking out the comment piece there, the comment wasn't in there. I mean, obviously, I just re-commented it out.
We shipped it with a comment, with the code right there, yes.
Yep. And then I could execute that so that it rebuilds the stored procedure. I could rerun my query, and now I see just the one line. So things are looking good. As a final test, I can go back to PWA and rerun that again so I can see what my report looks like now. So I just go back, put my hired resources in, recalculate, and hopefully, I don't say hopefully because I've recorded the video, so you know, I'm not stupid.
But you never know.
And there you go. So now we see the rate of 50, which was the A rate table I wanted, and not the two rows with 60 against them. So just an example of the way we can sort of, it probably took me a bit longer than 3 minutes and 11 seconds the first time I was trying to find the problem, but you get the idea of the kind of things you can sort of see going on in the database and how you can sort of analyze them. So back over to the presentation. I'm just going to do a very quick run through because I'm stealing all of Adrian's time as we're practically halfway through. Troubleshooting workflow issues. The additional workflow data is a great place to go. Clicking the information symbol will often tell you a little bit more than whether something's just been cancelled or it's run. Even if it's running, it may give you more information behind that information. For instance, if you haven't got an email account set up for somebody, you might see under the information that it's tried to use send mail, but it's failed because it's got nobody it can send the email to. So you can get more information there. The IIS logs, if you're running on premises, you can see who's actually connecting to the workflow web services. So if you're getting some kind of permission problem or a user problem, you can see who it thinks it's trying to connect as. Again, on premises, if you go to the database where your workflow management tables are, it will put some stuff into the debug traces there as well. So another great place to look. And the other key one, which I always try and do with customers if they're running into issues, is, okay, well, do other workflows work? Can we do a list workflow that's just running against a normal SharePoint list? Can we create a SharePoint site workflow that's just running against that? We can then try and establish whether it's something to do with how project's configured and with its workflow, or whether it's a more sort of underlying SharePoint problem that we're looking for. I mean, obviously, it's all still our problem, but it helps us to isolate where the issue is and where we need to look. So with that, I hand over to Adrian.
Okay.
You can have the clicker. I turn into heckle roll
rather than... All right, so how many of you have ever done anything with client logging? Okay, a couple. Okay, good. So this is not going to be like, I've seen this before, can we go on to something else type of thing. So with the client logging, why do we do it? First off, we want to be able to try to see what's happening between states of maybe something that you're doing. It could be I'm saving a project. It could be that I'm opening a project. I'm doing something within the grid within the project, or whatever the case may be. That allows us to see where a process starts and stops. And it's also very, very good, especially in 2007 and 2010, to help you understand what gets opened from the server and what gets saved from the server. And finally, why else would you do this? Because it's fun, right? Yeah, exactly. You know, as I was preparing this part of the presentation, I was trying to think of something new to do. We've talked about a lot of things, and it's like, what could I do? Sometimes I feel like the comedian who needs new jokes, and so this is my new joke for this session, okay? So play along with me.
Don't try and guess the punchline. It really spoils it.
Yeah, it really does. Okay, so let's start off with Project 2010 logging. Project 2010 logging actually applies to 2007 as well. In fact, that's where we started the logging. And a couple things you need to know. It's a sequential text file. When I wrote that, it's like, really? Is it going to be random? Of course it's sequential. But anyway, you can read the text file with Notepad, and that's probably your best option, or whatever you use to read really large text files, because these files can get very, very large. It is a property-based output, and when I show you some examples of this, I'll try to point out what I mean by properties, okay? And I have another slide coming up on that. Something to understand about 2007 and 2010 logging is it's only for active cache interaction. So if you are opening up an MPP file or you're doing something else within projects or Project Professional that has nothing to do with the server interaction with file open and file close, then the logging will do nothing for you, okay? And you're probably guessing now that we have something new for 2013. We do, so I'll get to that. All right, so to enable logging, and I don't expect you to copy all this down, unless if you want to take a picture or something like that, but I don't expect you to remember that the debug load seer category D word is 3ED, okay? I'll have to have some way for you to get this information, and maybe we can post it somewhere on a blog or something like that. I have no problem putting it on a blog. But a couple things that you need to know here on this. The first one, the WinProj log, that is something that you can change. That is the location where you want these log files to be dropped. This location needs to exist. You can't expect that logging will create a folder for you. So if it doesn't exist, you'll end up with no logs, obviously. Okay? The other three items there, the debug category, debug level, and the seer category, in 2007, 2010, don't worry about those. Don't play with them. Just leave them as is, okay? And everybody will be happy. No lives will be lost. Okay. Now, I mentioned that we, in the 2007 and 2010, you see a lot of properties, okay? And these are called PIDs or property IDs. And within the log file, you'll see tons of these things all over the case, all over the place. And you'll see something that says like PID equals blah, 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 and you'll see a value. Well, it'll give a PID, and that PID references a column or a field within project. And it'll give it in a hexadecimal format. In order for you to even make sense of what that number is, you typically will need to convert it into a decimal format. So you can take out your handy-dandy Windows calculator, turn it into the Programmer tab, and you can enter in the debug value and then click on the button that says, I want to see the integer value. So that's the way you can do some conversions. Now, here's where it gets very interesting. We don't have a list of all of the property IDs that project uses. Some of them are internal to project, things that you would never see in your entire lifetime unless if you had source code. But there are a lot of things like task name. What's the property ID for that? Honestly, I don't know what it is. I have some sources that makes it a little bit easier for me to figure that out. For the common things, though, like custom built-in local fields and enterprise custom fields, you can get that information directly from a project server database. Because in the conversions table, all of those fields are listed there. You'll see the actual name, like text 1, number 2, date 3, or whatever the case may be, and you'll see the ID for that. Those IDs are listed in decimal format, and then, of course, you could convert it to be the PID if you wanted to. Now, you're probably saying, this is useless. How am I going to use this? Because if I want to see what the task name is, what that property ID is, how do I do that? Well, you're all very creative, right? Yep, of course you're going to say yes, okay? So you can do something simple like opening up a brand new project, entering in a task, and in the task name you could put in, this is my very special task name, okay? You can then save it to the server. And then you look at the log file and you search for that text string called, this is my favorite task name, okay? And then it'll tell you what the PID number is based on that, because it'll say PID, blah, 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 and then the value equals whatever it was that you entered. So I'll show you an example of this in the log file, but that's the way you can kind of help yourself do this. So let's go ahead and I need to take a timeout here. Now, the reason for this is because I'm going to show you an example where someone was saving a file to the server and something bad happened. Okay, and so when you save a project to the server, well, actually, my example here is open. Open and save, the same sorts of things are happening, and there are PSI calls that are sent to the server, and they're done over a SOAP channel. Okay, now the primary ones for project on open are read project status, and that's just a very basic, hey, do you have a project? You know, tell me what you have here. Then there's a pre-read project, which reads a lot of properties about the project itself. Things like, is it checked out? Is it available? You know, what's the name? You know, what are the names and all those sorts of things at the top level of the project? And then we get to the next two. These are really, as the name implies, core data. The first one, the project core data, that is all of your schedule information. That'd be things like calendars, resources, assignments, tasks, dependencies, and all your custom field information. That's the core information. Now, the second one, the non-core data, that's things like your views, tables, filters, grouping, reports. In Project 2013, that would be all the special new reports and things of that nature. And it also contains all of your baseline data. So you may think that your baseline data is core. Well, according to Project, it's not. I mean, it's separated it out. Now, then we have the post-read, which is just a quick command to say, did everything go okay? Are we ready to move on to the next thing? We have read enterprise resource and SRA data. That should make sense based on the name. That's where we get the SRA information if you've loaded that. And we start merging it into the project because that stuff changes all the time. In fact, if you go to your resource usage view, you'll notice that every time you open up the project, those values could change based on the SRA data. And so we get that fresh each time you open up the project. And we also do that on some of the save commands as well. And finally, we get the matching resources. In your project, it's going to have a fixed list of resources, whatever it was last saved with. And so we need to do a command here to figure out if there is new resource information that we need to merge into that project. So let's suppose I saved my project with the resource name Brian Smith. At that time, Brian was a local resource. Later on, I went into the resource pool and I said, Brian, you are now promoted to an official enterprise resource. He feels really good about that. And so the next time I open up the project, however, it's going to do that call, the get matching resources, and it's going to say, oh, by the way, I found a resource with the same name as one on the enterprise. Do you want to match these two together, or do you want to rename the local one so there's not a collision? So that's what that command does right there, is it does all that matching.
There couldn't be more than one Brian Smith. I mean, there's only five in Microsoft.
Right, right. Now, the last point here is very important. If any of these calls fail, then the file open fails. How many of you have ever seen the case where you're opening up something from the project and you see the progress indicator go, then all of a sudden it goes back to nothing and you're left looking at the same project you started with, okay? That's because one of these calls failed during the process. Now, here's where you can try to figure out which one failed, okay? And that may help you figure out what a solution could be. And again, with all of these things, it may be something that you need to contact us so we can help you figure that out, or maybe you can figure it out yourself, but at least you'll have a better idea and you can help us help you. Oops, I need to press the right button here. Okay. All right, so in this example here, I want to show you what would happen if I wanted to figure out if a baseline value got saved, okay? So at the top it says, did the task baseline start get saved? Well, in order to do this, you need to start gathering some information. You need at least, since you want to see if the task baseline got saved, you need the task GUID, right? Makes sense. That's the way we're going to uniquely identify that. You need to get the PID, again, the property ID. Now you're going, what's the property ID? What is it for the baseline start field? This is one of those cases where you could do a little bit of experimenting and figure out what that is. And then you would look into the log and see what the value says. Now, the little grid below here, I have a couple of examples. I have a task with a GUID starting with 90, one with A7. You can see that the baseline start was NA on the first and 123.14 on the second one. Now, going into that, I know the task GUID equals that 90F. I found out that the PIDs are, wait a minute, there are two of them. Okay, there's the B4002B and B4005.13. Why are there two? Okay, remember with Project 2010, we now have manually scheduled tasks, and so when you save a baseline, you actually get two because we're saving baseline values for the manually scheduled start and finish and duration and so forth, and then also for the schedule itself. So the manually scheduled baseline could say that the start is next week, whereas the scheduled baseline start is an exact date. So I know that those two are my PIDs, and so I look in the log, and what do I see? I see, right there, that set to null PID equal B4005.13 value equals something, type equals string, and then the next one right there is B4002B to null, okay? So can you guess which one of those is which? Anyone want to guess? And can you tell me what happened here? Okay, I'll give it away. So the first one right here where it's the string, that happens to be that one right there, and that happens to be the manually scheduled baseline because it's a string type. This one right here where it says, you know, B4002B to null, remember on the previous screen right here, I set the baseline to NA, and so it set it to null. So this right here, looking at the log, I can tell that project at least recognized that there was a change and that it did save it to the local cache. Now, if I find that in the database I don't have the value equal null, then I need to start doing some other things like maybe a SQL trace or whatever. But this would be a starting point to say, did the data at least go from the sheet where I entered the information into the local cache and did it get sent to the server? So there are a lot of things that we can do along the ways to see where the data or where and how the data flows to see if we're getting the right result, what we expect. Okay, so you may be thinking, well, that's kind of interesting, maybe not so much. Let me show you another example, and you might find this one a little bit more interesting. So what went wrong here? I've highlighted the bad things in red, because red always means bad, right? Or it means stop or something like that. So the first one, and this log right here, I didn't remove anything in between. So I didn't remove a lot of lines just to show you the few things right here. This is exactly as it came out of the log. It says the first one, unhandled communication fault error. Does that sound deadly to you? Yeah, that's not very good. So something in the communication, which is that SOAP call that goes to the server, that PSI call across the SOAP channel, something failed. Now the next one says the request channel timed out while waiting for a reply after 00:02:59.998000. Okay, what does that tell me? Well, that tells me after almost exactly 3 minutes, the channel timed out. Okay, now you might be thinking, well, why don't we just increase the timeout? We might be able to do that if we thought that 3 minutes is just not sufficient, but for this particular case, the customer said, it was working good yesterday, but today it's not. Well, looking at the log, it's like I can see why, because 3 minutes is an awful long time for project to say, hey, server, I need some information. Give it back to me, and I'll deal with it. In this case, project waited around for 3 minutes and finally said, nothing's happening. I'm not going to wait around much longer because something really bad could have happened. I just have to give up here. So what really happened here? What PSI call failed? Well, here we can see the read project non-core data. I should help everyone on this side see it as well, not point the laser in somebody's eye. Sorry about that. You can see the read project non-core data, too. Remember that one? That is things like your baseline and views and tables and filters. And it's like, that's very interesting. So at this point, I thought, well, let me see how large that data is. And so I pulled out Fiddler, and I loaded up Fiddler, and it came back, and, you know, really it didn't look that bad. It was kind of along the same size as the core data itself. So I thought, well, that's really strange. So at that point, it really told me that project was doing okay. There was nothing fishy on the project side. So I thought, well, we need to go look at the server itself. And in the end, just to cut things really short as I can, I ended up looking at a SQL trace and found that things were not running efficiently on the SQL server itself. The statistics had gotten really, really far out of date. And so I ended up doing a DBCC free proc cache. So I freed the procedure cache on the SQL server. And suddenly, this command that was failing after 3 seconds or 3 minutes was now taking about less than a second to execute. So this is a way that I used client logging to help figure out where the problem was, because I didn't know if it was on project, because sometimes the problem can actually be on project itself, and there are some things that we might have to do there to change some things around. Again, I could have gone in, and there is a timeout that I can change on the SOAP command within the client to say, I want it to take 15 minutes. And probably it might have worked after 15 minutes, but that's way too long to ask anyone to wait around for a project that was normally opening within 20 seconds, 10 to 20 seconds before. So, you know, just increasing timeouts is not necessarily the best way to go.
Yeah, I'm okay for increasing timeouts if you're just using it as a troubleshooting step.
Yeah.
But, you know, you don't want to keep pushing the timeout up because, you know, your users have got better things to do than just keep waiting longer. We need to get to the root cause of stuff. Most of our timeouts are set at reasonable values, so, you know, you shouldn't be hitting them. If you are, it's generally SQL's running bad or something like that.
Right. Okay, so let's look at 2013 logging. As I mentioned already, there are some things that are different. Again, it's a sequential text file, not random. Don't know why I put that there. But it's in the ULS format. So if you're familiar with logging in SharePoint and Project Server, the ULS log format, it's exactly the same, which means you can use the exact same tools to do all your filtering and figure out which categories you want to look at and so forth. excuse me. It is function-based, and I'll show you some examples of this, whereas the 2010 is just a lot of little PIDs that you see going on and things like that. This one here will tell you that it entered a function and whether or not it exited that function. And they're very interesting if you want to see what project is doing behind the hood, and if you kind of want to see what the source code is doing. These function calls are actually the exact function calls that are in WinProj. So, you know, we're kind of exposing a little bit of our functionality here, and you can look to see what's going on. Now, the great thing about the 2013 client logging is it works without server. This will log you opening an MPP file. This will log you leveling your project. This will log you doing things like entering text into your Gantt chart. This will log all of those types of things, which means your log files could get very, very large if you let them. It can consume your entire hard drive if you left it in, let's say, a day or two or something like that. So I'll talk about what to do in that case. Now, Brian already talked about the diagnostics packages. There's a package for 2013 where it'll go through. Of course, you get the email here. You run it, and then you get to the diagnostic login here. You click on start, and it goes through the wizard, and it'll tell you to start project. It'll tell you to reproduce your problem and then to exit out a project when you're done. And at that point, it will go ahead and send the diagnostics package back to us at Microsoft. Now, there are going to be times where you're not going to necessarily be able to reproduce the problem right away because, well, it's one of those, you know, blue moon type things that happens who knows when, and you just can't leave logging on turned on at that verbose level for that long. So there are some other things that we can do. So here are the registry keys for 2013. You can notice that there are a few new things right here. There's enable logging, enable text file logging, and quite honestly, I don't remember the difference between those two. I just turn them both on and it works. And if I turn one on, it seems to work as well. You see the same one right here, the WinProj log. Now these categories, debug levels and that, the debug level is something that you can play with, okay? The values that you can play with are 1 to 6, okay? So if you want to just monitor the unexpected things, those once in a blue moon things, you would set the monitoring level to 1. And that would be actually a fairly nice thing to do if you want to leave logging turned on for a while because it's not going to be creating a whole lot of log there. It's just going to every so often put something into the log. Now, when you get that diagnostics package, it sets everything to verbose, number 5. And that's pretty intense. Verbose extended right here, very intense. I did a test right before I came. I was in my room. I was on a call, and I was trying some things out. And I set it to verbose, and I opened up a one-task project, and I closed down project, and it created 1.5 gigabytes of log. So it's very verbose. So use it sparingly, okay? Now, there's some additional logging. You can change, there are 37 different categories of information that you can log in Project 2013. Everything from, I want to see what leveling's doing, I want to see what the file I/O is doing, and so forth. Here I gave you 3 examples of load, save, cache, serializer. you know, what are the other category names? You can always start up the logging on Verbose, and at the top of the file, it will always show you the 37 categories, and it'll show you what value they're being logged at. Now, this here, this line where I say the logging, this is an additional thing that you can put into the registry editor, and you can set each one of these individually the way you want. So I could say that overall I want logging to be at value 1, which means I don't want to see a whole lot, but maybe only on these three things I want to see verbose or extended verbose logging. That way you can kind of focus in on the things that you're interested in. Again, the category names, I will show you some in a moment. Some of them, I don't even know what they do, and I'm not really interested in them, but others are very helpful, like, you know, the load save and things of that nature. Okay? The name ext file, this particular file is created anytime you connect to Project Server. If you don't connect to Project Server, you won't see that log file there. You'll just see the other log file. But you get two log files if you connect to Server. All right, so here's where we get to show a couple of things. If this all works well, it did. Okay. Let me first go to 2010. This is a log file from 2010, and 2007 would look almost identical to this. In fact, it should be. Now here you can see a few things like the proj name equal global. So this is where it was opening up the global template file. You can see here is a execute SOAP call method read project core data 2. Looks fairly familiar, right? And at the end of this log file, remember that example I gave you where it timed out? I actually have it at the end of this file here. So that's what I did, since I knew that the problem reoccurred, I mean, the repro was, I did this thing, then project stopped doing what it was supposed to do. I didn't have to go through the top of the file here to figure out where to go. I just went to the bottom and worked my way up. So typically, you can do that sort of thing if you know that at a certain time or whatever, there was my problem. You can work your way up and then sort of see what happened in essence, like the call stack would be. Now, I said that you'll see a lot of PIDs, like there's a PID X2, PID X, you know, just all kinds of these things right here, these PIDs all over the place. So that's the reason why I say this is kind of PID-based, because you'll see all of that kind of detail about every little last thing that project was reading or writing from that particular project. On the other hand, if I go to 2010, and I'm looking at this particular log within a ULS viewer, because this is the way I like using them, because I can do filtering and formatting and all kinds of great things here. But you can see here that I have entering function, leaving function. Now how about this one right here, showing splash screen. So this was on Buddha project, and it came back and said, oh, I'm showing the splash screen. So as, you know, you can at least tell it was doing that much. But that may help you to understand where in the process things were getting to, where it succeeded, where it failed. Now, at the end of this file here, let me go down to the bottom. You can see that I can also get some of the PID type stuff right here. So setting bool PID, blah, blah, blah. And again, I would have to use a calculator to figure out what that is and then equate it to an actual field that I know of within project. So this is what it looks like. And it gives you a lot of that information. Again, this may be interesting to you because it may help you to understand what did project do. But for some of you, it's like, I don't know. But just realize that we may ask you to get some of this information for us, because it is very useful to me, very useful to other people on the team, to the developers and stuff like that. So be aware that this just may be something that we ask you to do. And if you want to take a look at it, that's great. All right. Here's the name ext file. Remember how I said the 37 categories are listed there? So I don't know what cat none equals right there. I don't know what that category is. Here are the SOAP, all the things surrounding SOAP. Here's front end doc. That's things like your views, tables, and filters, and things like that. Here's a calculation service. Obviously, I'm not going to see the PJ calc service on the client, But for your information, the scheduling service on the server is based on the WinProj code, which is the client code itself. And so I would see that sort of thing right there if I were setting up this logging on the server to see what the calculation service was doing. Okay, so let me switch back to the slides here. All right. I think I clicked the clicker. Okay, there we go. I clicked the clicker when I meant to do something else, and I went a couple slides forward. So here is a 2013 example. Again, these are all of the things that happened in between the blue lines right here. I highlighted them. So I started right here. I knew that something bad happened. And so I looked up here at the function where it was entering in. This is, okay, I'm writing a row to the stream. Well, writing a row, that means it sounds like it's saving something. And then I was able to finally go down here to the bottom. It says setting PID for, or C4002DD to null. You've seen that before, that null type thing. And setting rate PID to null 2DD. Okay, rate, that sounds pretty interesting. And a rate would be like a cost rate. And in fact, when I looked up this PID and stuff like that, I could tell that it was actually associated with, in fact, right here, I forgot to show you this part right here. See this PID? There is a GUID, and I looked that up, and that happened to be a resource within the project. And then this right here, what the problem was, it was having a problem setting the rate for one of the resources within the project. So I was able to find which resource had the problem, then was able to kind of go in and manipulate things and get it past its hiccup right there and get it fixed. And that was without doing anything special. I just was able to look at the log. You know, you're saying, yeah, you just looked at the log. You know, I do this. You know, I do this a lot, obviously. But I was able to look at the log, and with some amount of work, I was able to figure that out. And so, again, this could be a tool that's useful to you. If not, hopefully it was interesting. All right, so what happened? I went through that there. And so I was able to translate the 2D8 into the PID, which is the 728, which equals a res UID. There's the value of the GUID for it. And then it was setting this in the rate table. So that's what I did. So at this point, with anything you do, whenever you're doing debugging and stuff like that or troubleshooting, sometimes you have to set out a hypothesis, and then you have to go prove or disprove what it is that you're setting out to do. So there's tons of information that comes into you from all of these different sources about a problem. You need to just methodically throw out the stuff that you know is just totally irrelevant, and then start looking down the different paths of data that you have, and then say, well, could it be this thing? Let me test it out. Let me see what I can get from that. And it could be getting some logging or testing things and so forth. Anyway, here are the reasons why you do client logging. It can be fun to dig around or not, so just keep that in mind. But it can help you identify problems. So at this point, I'm done with mine part of the presentation. We have a short time for questions, and so please fire away. And if you can go to a microphone, that's very handy. Yes, right there.
Quick question. Do you have anything from a new user perspective, like an on-trail business? It's often you get, you know, project manager reporting, hey, someone changed something on my project, they deleted the project, and someone else does it. Rather than just try to go through these miles of logs, is there some sort of on-trail that you can actually activate?
So the question is there an audit trail that you can really look at to see who did what and where and when? There's not. I mean, if you're talking about timesheets, you can turn on auditing there, but within the system itself, we do not have an auditable trail, and I can't say that very well. I know that I've heard of some partners in that have tools and add-ons and things of that nature, but there's nothing built within project. Yes, right here, and then back there. Is there any, do we want to make the DB diag available without a support case? I don't know.
We've often thought about that. One of the challenges is we do sort of update it. So one of the dangers is you've got your DB diags, but you're not necessarily picking up all the new stuff. Whereas if you open a support case, you'll get in the latest compiled ones that may have more rules in it. One of the things, because it's just based on SQL in a lot of cases, I suppose there's the potential that we could share some of those queries that we're actually running in particular cases. So that might be a way that we can sort of give you the guts of it without sort of having to build it into a tool. So that's certainly something we can look at.
And I've had some customers ask for specific parts of that, and so
yeah,
because they always wanted to test a certain thing in their environment, so I gave them the SQL queries. Yeah. Okay, back there. Okay. All right. That's okay. Great question. The question is sometimes looking in the queue, you'll look at a job and it's failed or whatever. You click on the little link that's supposed to show you a message about what went wrong. It'll say root element missing. Okay. What is that? Well, that means that something happened before even an error message came back and it was able to create and assemble an error message. And so those error messages are in XML format. And so that's just telling you that it didn't create any XML for it to display anything. And it's a stupid way to do it. I mean, it should at least say there's nothing here to show you rather than root element missing. But what that typically means is that somewhere along the line, something happened on the server. Typically where you'll see something like that is that maybe I'm saving something from project and project will start trying to do what it's supposed to, or project server is trying to do what it's supposed to do. The client may actually tell the server, hold on, I'm not ready to do that, or I had an error myself that I don't know how to handle. And so it basically shuts down the whole thing over to the server. The server says, okay. And so it just says, well, it failed, and I don't even have an error message to give to you. So in cases like that, that's where we have to start looking at, is there any client logging that we can do to figure out why it failed there in order for it to finally get to the server and give us that kind of dumb error? Okay, right here in the front.
Is there any advice for long publish time
for projects? So okay. The question is there any help for long publish and stuff like that?
Patience.
Well, let's first talk about what happens in a publish, okay? There are a number of things that occur. It depends on whether it's the first publish, second publish, or whatever the case may be. So first publish, of course, we have to take all the stuff from the draft database, move it into the publish database, and then from there we take it and we put it into the reporting database, and we also create a site and all of those sorts of things. Typically where the long publish is going to come from is when it has to take that information from the publish database and take things like, time phase data. And in your reporting database, it has to put it in that time phase by day table and things like that. And so it may be putting millions of records there, and that can take longer than expected. Now, in other cases, a publish may mean that it has to delete some information. We did a fix here recently where publish was taking a very, very long time, and it wasn't because of all that time phase by day data that it was having a problem with. It was actually having a problem with deleting elements that it needed to from the published database based on the differences that were in the draft database. And that came down to basically a stored procedure that wasn't querying tightly enough. It was basically coming back and saying, okay, show me all of the shadow records for this. And it was coming back with millions of records versus saying, show me all the shadow records for the project I'm working on, and then we'll deal with it. And so it was a very simple fix, but it made a huge amount of difference in the performance. So if you're seeing slow times, that may be something where a SQL trace can help you to understand what's happening. It may not help you necessarily fix it, or maybe it does because you can look at the SPROC or the query that's running slowly and see maybe that there is an index that's not it's not covering as well as it should, and so forth. You have something to say on that one, too?
I'll be saying something about that in my next session at 5 o'clock. So,
well, there you go. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Go ahead.
Do you recommend running the diagnostic tool just to ensure optimum performance or just when you experience issues?
There are bits of the tool that I think that could be helpful because it can very easily show you if you have fragmented indexes and things like that. Now, typically, you would hopefully you would have a maintenance plan for your SQL Server, so it's not a big surprise to you when you see that. It's not like, wow, how did that happen? But do be aware that some of the indexes and that on our tables can get fragmented very quickly, and in some cases that's going to be okay. But for other tables, like let's say my task table or something like that, you shouldn't be seeing huge fragmentation, you know. And if it is fragmented, then you need to make sure you rebuild those indexes on a periodic basis.
And one last question, because I think we're just over time.
Yeah.
Can you tell me on Project Pro 2013, when you're doing a publish, what it's doing at 65%?
65%.
At 65%, you know, I can't tell you off the top of my head, but
yeah,
give me some code and I'll tell you.
Yeah, the percentage is basically any...
What about 71?
No. I mean, how about 94? I don't know.
We thought about doing a blog posting on the sort of percentages, but one of the problems is that different jobs... the percentage isn't very accurate. It's the... You know, if I've got five jobs to do, then it's going to be 20, 40, 60, 80, 100. Or is that six? But...
Yeah.
So the percentages will vary depending on how many jobs there are. So if you're doing a particular project that hasn't got baselines, perhaps there'd be fewer jobs to do. So the percentage when it gets to, say, summary resource assignments might change between, I don't know, 94 and 93 or something like that. But, you know, we probably could give some sort of idea what's going on. We've certainly got some internal sort of records of what they are. But, you know, it's not always going to be exactly the same thing.
We could get pretty darn close.
Yeah, but the reason it sort of stops at one point, it just means that that step actually consumes a lot of time. It doesn't mean, you know, it stopped doing anything. It might mean that the first sort of half the steps are all very fast, but that particular step takes some time, and then other steps sort of take more time.
Yeah, so
the
progress...
So sometimes it's just slow at that point. Other times, if it stops at that point, then that gives us a better idea about what's actually... sort of crashing at that.
And in that case, that would be a good place to say, well, can I look at anything in SQL? What's it doing at that point? You know, start the profiler right as it hits the 65% or whatever. That may help you to understand. I was just going to say that, like Brian was saying, that the percentages are based on the number of sub-jobs that are happening within the major job itself. The major job maybe being send it to the reporting database or whatever the case may be. So you may see some where it goes from 0 to 100% and nothing in between because there was only one thing that was doing. It was either done or not done. Whereas in something like save, there's over, gosh, it seems like there are over 110, 15 different things that it does. And so the progress, obviously, is much more incremental. But 65%, it sounds very familiar, but I just can't quite remember.
Okay, well, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you for coming.